I'm Dr. Diaz. This is my partner, Dr. Michael Hopkins. Welcome everyone to the PS314 Colorectal Surgical Emergencies, What to Do in the Middle of the Night. Gonna go ahead and start just a few minutes early to give everybody some time, and it looks like our room is full. Clearly a topic of many interests, especially for many of us who do middle of the night emergency surgery, even if that is not what you routinely do. It's always helpful to have a few tricks up your sleeve. Our first speaker, Dr. Angela Coonan, is going to talk to us about uncontrolled lower GI bleed, what to do next. She is a graduate of Yale. She received her medical degree from New York University, completed her general surgery training here at the MGH, during which time she served a couple of years in the lab doing some GI epithelial biology. Completed her colorectal training at Lahey Clinic during her year as an associate professor at Boston, where she won several teaching awards. She is now back on staff at Lahey Clinic. Without further ado, Dr. Coonan.
Good morning, and thank you for the privilege of the podium. I'm going to talk about uncontrolled lower GI bleeding and what to do in the middle of the night. I have no disclosures. So I'm going to start with a patient story. This is actually my grandmother. She spent her entire life in Woburn, just north of Boston, and she had a very big impact on me. First of all, so two things that really are pertinent to this week. First of all, she made sure that every one of her family members was a avid Red Sox fan. And then second of all, one of my strong childhood memories was when she had a massive GI bleed from an AVM. And presented to the emergency room hypotensive with hematochezia. This is not at all an uncommon story. Gastrointestinal bleeding is the number one cause of hospitalization due to gastrointestinal disease, and about 20% of these cases are due to acute overt lower GI bleeding. Classically, lower GI bleeding presents as hematochezia, but about 15% of severe hematochezia is from an upper source. In most cases, the bleeding does stop without intervention. I'm going to go through the different goals of treatment here, starting with the resuscitation of the patient. And I do think it's important that we as surgeons know that the American College of Gastroenterology 2 years ago did publish clinical guidelines for management of acute lower GI bleed, starting with IV fluid resuscitation to normalize hemodynamics. They did not set hemodynamic parameters to use as a goal, but they did state that transfusion of packed red blood cells to maintain a hemoglobin with a goal of 7 was the ideal. This is actually based on survival advantage in a study with upper GI bleed patients where they compared a goal of 7 versus 9 and did show a survival advantage with the lower transfusion trigger. They did exclude patients with ischemic cardiovascular disease and other major comorbidities. They also discussed management of coagulation defects with deferring endoscopy until the INR has been reversed to a level less than 2.5 and transfusion of the platelets to a level of 50. They talk about the idea of transfusing platelets and plasma if a massive red blood cell transfusion is needed. And this is based on trauma literature that we all know very well with the 1-to-1-to-1 ratio, but not based on any data in GI bleeding. They also talk about the new target-specific oral anticoagulants. These are known to increase the risk of GI bleeding, but have no reversal agents. And so they do put us in a bit of a predicament when we're managing these patients. We have to let the medications wear off and just support the patients through. So the presentation of lower GI bleeding varies based on the rate of bleeding. This can be categorized as minor bleeding, major bleeding, and massive bleeding. For patients presenting in true extremis, those who are pulseless obviously need CPR. There is some talk about dramatic salvage options, applying the principles of trauma management, which we're familiar with. There are no reported outcomes of resuscitative thoracotomy for lower GI bleed, though it's been discussed. Obviously, the outcomes of this are likely poor. But there is description of use of REBOA, the resuscitative endovascular balloon occlusion of the aorta device, for non-traumatic bleeding. A small series of REBOA and non-traumatic bleeding was published recently, showing a mortality rate of 36% early, despite 64% of these patients presenting in cardiac arrest. Obviously, we have very little data on this, but I think there's going to be more to come with this as a good tool. Next, we'll talk about localization of the source and, along with that, control of bleeding. An important anatomic distinction is that upper GI bleeds are caused by bleeding proximal to the ligament of Treitz, and lower GI bleeds are distal to the ligament of Treitz. There is a description of the term middle GI bleeding, which is small intestinal bleeding. If patients, again, have known liver disease or stigmata or hematemesis or any concern of upper GI bleeding, it's very important to exclude that before moving forward with treatment for a lower GI bleed. So once we've established that the patient has a lower GI bleed, if they're stable, then the next step is to go to endoscopy. If not, then radiology. These are the most common causes of acute lower GI bleeding listed in order of frequency, with diverticulosis being the most common. Most of these present with large volume, painless bleeding, but a number of them present with abdominal pain, fever, and diarrhea with a very different presentation. And so this can help you figure out what the cause of the bleeding is. Colonoscopy should be the initial diagnostic procedure in nearly all patients with an acute lower GI bleed once they're hemodynamically stable and have had a bowel preparation. It's not useful to do unprepped lower endoscopy in these patients. It is a good idea to try to intubate the terminal ileum to rule out proximal blood in the small intestine. Notably, identification of a non-bleeding diverticula or angiodysplasia should not be considered adequate source localization, as these are often multiple and not necessarily the cause of the bleeding. There are multiple endoscopic hemostatic techniques that have been described. They've not been compared head-to-head in trials. Epinephrine injection is useful as an adjunct to temporize bleeding and allow for use of these other methods here. Thermal coagulation and argon beam coagulation are very helpful in treatment of AVMs. Clip application and band ligation is helpful in diverticular bleeds. There are a number of different topical hemostatic agents that can be placed through the colonoscope, and these result in high immediate hemostasis but have a very high rebleeding rate. And then polypectomy for bleeding polyps is a useful technique as well. This here in figure A shows a bleeding diverticulum and then resolution of the bleeding after clip placement. Dr. Strait looked at a series of diverticular bleeds, and they were able to control these endoscopically in about 92% of cases. There was a rate of rebleeding 8% early and 12% late. The rate of adverse events was very low, and they did note that it's helpful to clip or tattoo the area of bleeding in case the patient rebleeds for subsequent intervention. In cases where the source remains obscure after colonoscopic evaluation, looking at the small intestine is very important. Traditionally, this was done with push enteroscopy or double balloon enteroscopy. This uses a very long endoscope, oftentimes with an overtube and a balloon that allows you to serially advance the scope far into the small intestine. And this allows for diagnosis and treatment of small intestinal bleeding. It's technically challenging and very time intensive. It requires an advanced endoscopist, and so it's not the most practical measure. Capsule endoscopy is now the standard measure to evaluate the small intestine for bleeding. These are these pill-sized disposable wireless cameras that patients swallow. They travel through the small intestine and take hundreds of pictures over several hours. And then the photos are transmitted to a receptor, and they can be evaluated. It does take time, and there is the major risk of capsule retention, which we worry about a lot in our IBD patients. This requires either endoscopy or surgery to remove the capsule. So in the case where our patients are unstable for colonoscopy, if they have ongoing bleeding, a negative EGD, and an inadequate response to resuscitation, they need to go to radiology as the first step. CT angiography about 10 years ago really was not part of the paradigm for evaluation of lower GI bleed, but in 2013, a meta-analysis reported the use of CTA for detection and localization of acute GI bleeds with a very high sensitivity and specificity for this. And it was able to detect bleeding rates as low as 0.3 milliliters per second, which is quite sensitive. This is done using a triple phase study. The first CT scan uses a non-contrast series to identify pre-existing hyperdense materials that would distract interpretation of the subsequent images. Second is an arterial phase, ideally when the contrast reaches the lumen of the bowel. And third is a portal venous phase, about 50 seconds after the arterial phase. We do not use enteric contrast in these studies because it does confuse the pictures. Active extravasation is seen as a blush or hyper-attenuating focus in the bowel lumen. We have some examples of this here. In figure A, we have a non-contrast cut of the sigmoid colon. In figure B, you can see here, there's an arterial blush in the lumen of the sigmoid colon. In the portal venous phase, we see expansion and propagation of that contrast through the lumen of the bowel. This was actually a patient of mine, an elderly man who underwent emergency CABG, and about 2 months later in the ICU with ischemic digits and kidneys, developed a massive lower GI bleed. This first non-contrast axial image, the hyperdense image there is actually the coccyx. In figure B, we see arterial extravasation from the distal rectum. and then propagation of the contrast in the lumen. He was not felt to be a good candidate for angiography, so I took him to the operating room and did a transanal examination and oversaw of a distal rectal ulcer, which was ultimately felt to be ischemic. His internal iliac arteries were out from calcifications. This is the retroflexion view on flexible sigmoidoscopy after the exam, after the oversaw. So CT angiography has the advantages of being readily available, minimally invasive, and providing a lot of further clinical information, including evidence of colitis or enteritis, diverticulosis, bowel ischemia, tumors, and vascular anatomy. The disadvantages of it are that it does include a high radiation dose because of the triple phase CT scan, and then obviously the risks of IV contrast nephropathy and IV contrast allergy. The gold standard traditionally has been catheter angiography. This has great diagnostic and therapeutic potential, but has a lower sensitivity than CTA, with a bleeding rate of 1 cc per minute required. The use of super-selective transcatheter embolization using microcoils or other agents to block the vessels in a very selective fashion has resulted in a much lower rate of ischemic complications, less than 5%. Dr. Gillespie prospectively evaluated 107 cases of lower GI bleed with angiography. They were able to identify the site of bleeding in about half of patients and performed embolizations in almost all of these patients. All of the patients had cessation of the bleeding early, but about a quarter of them re-bled. Repeat embolization they found to be associated with a very high rate of ischemic events. And of the patients where angiography did not show active bleeding, about a quarter of the patients continued to re-bleed. So we do reserve this technique for patients with very brisk ongoing bleeding because of the risk profile and also the level of invasiveness. In cases where angiography identifies the location of bleeding but can't control it, it's a good idea to leave the catheter in the vessel, so in the mesentery, to mark the bleeding site so that you can then take the patient to the operating room for urgent segmental resection. The use of provocative angiography and also provocative colonoscopy, where we infuse thrombolytics and anticoagulants to induce bleeding and aid in localization, is pretty controversial. There's not a lot of data on it. And the risk of torrential hemorrhage is significant. So you have to have immediate access to an operating room and an anesthesia team if you're going to undertake this. Just briefly, we'll talk about radionucleotide imaging, which is not particularly useful in the acute setting. Tagged red blood cell scans, patients are injected with autologous tagged red blood cells and then undergo scintigraphy every minute for 90 minutes up to 24 hours, so it takes a lot of time. This is the most sensitive imaging modality we have, detecting bleeding rates of 0.5 cc's per minute, and the disadvantage is that it localizes to quadrants of the abdomen but not specific anatomic features, so it's not very helpful in surgical planning. Meckel scans in select patients are very useful. They are only positive if there's ectopic gastric tissue in the Meckel's diverticulum, not pancreatic tissue. But if it's positive in the right lower quadrant, it's appropriate to bring the patient to the operating room for a segmental resection of the diverticulum and also the surrounding small intestine. So remember that usually the bleeding ulcer is not in the diverticulum, but on the mesenteric border downstream from the diverticulum. So you do have to resect and look for that ulcer. So as a last resort, surgical options. These are reserved for patients with ongoing bleeding despite angiographic and endoscopic management or multiple episodes of bleeding. There's not a lot of good data to support decision making in these cases. If the bleeding site has been confidently localized by colonoscopy or angiography, we can consider a segmental colectomy, but with the understanding that segmental resection in the setting of pre-op localization does carry a significant rebleeding risk, up to 14% in the setting of a segmental colectomy with pre-op localization versus up to 4% with subtotal colectomy. Patients have a high overall mortality after emergent total abdominal colectomy for massive GI bleed. If the source remains obscure, it's important to consider a small bowel source prior to surgery, as some series have described a small bowel source in these settings as the cause in up to 35% of cases. So fortunately, this clinical scenario is uncommon. If the ileocecal valve at surgery is felt to be competent and the small bowel is free of blood, then you can proceed with a subtotal colectomy. This is the only resection that should be performed as a last resort in the setting of unlocalized bleeding. If the small bowel does contain blood, then the first thing to do is inspect the small intestine for a palpable mass, abnormal vessels, and evidence of diverticuli as the cause of bleeding. And also consider intraoperative enteroscopy, which is shown here, to localize small intestinal bleeding. If a neoplasm is expected, do perform an oncologic mesenteric resection if possible. rarely obscure GI bleeding can't be localized to either the small intestine or the large intestine. And if this is the case with intermittent bleeds, a good technique is to just perform a laparoscopic loop ileostomy and watch the patient for further episodes of bleeding. This allows you to localize to the small intestine or the large intestine. There's this interesting case report from a number of years ago describing a patient who had a subtotal colectomy for an unlocalized GI bleed and continued to bleed, and they, despite multiple operations and other interventions, they could not localize the bleeding in the small intestine. So what they did is every meter created a stoma, and then refed the succus into the different stomas and were able to localize the bleeding to one of the segments. They resected that segment, closed all of the stomas, and the patient did well and had no further bleeding. They did find an angioma in that one segment of small intestine. So now we're going to talk about bleeding that we cause, post-procedural bleeding. Post-polypectomy bleeding, fortunately, is usually self-limited, but it does sometimes require urgent colonoscopy. That is the first measure in post-polypectomy bleeding. Often it can be controlled with a clip. Sometimes they need to go to angiography, very, very rarely surgery for this. Most of us are familiar with bleeding after rubber band ligation of internal hemorrhoids. It can be very impressive, and it usually does occur 1 to 3 weeks after the procedure when the ischemic tissue sloughs and there's an open ulcer. This is the reason that most people do not perform band ligation of patients on anticoagulation, so Coumadin or Plavix. I do not rubber band ligate those hemorrhoids. This also is usually self-limited, but does sometimes require a return to the operating room for suture ligation of the bleeding site. And then management of anastomotic bleeds, there's very little data on this. First, most of us use techniques at surgery to try to minimize the risk of this. First of all, using the anti-mesenteric side of the bowel for a side-to-side anastomosis, avoiding the mesenteric blood vessels, and then inspecting the luminal side of the linear staple lines to look for bleeding sites that can be controlled before the anastomosis is completed. This occurs in some series in about 6% of patients after colectomy. Most of this bleeding stops without intervention, but about 1% do require intervention. The first line should be colonoscopy, and oftentimes I find the gastroenterologists are hesitant to scope patients after surgery, and I always say we leak test almost all of our distal anastomoses, and we don't feel that we cause leaks with that. So I tell them, I think if we give them the blessing, then they'll often go forward with it, but it's a good way to control the bleeding. Angiography has been described as well in a limited series of patients with selective catheter embolization of anastomotic bleeds, both early and then years after anastomosis. And they've described no anastomotic leaks as the result of embolization, but they did have a high rebleed rate. And then as a last resort, if we can't control the bleeding with these measures, the option to return to the operating room and revise the anastomosis is one. I'm not going to go through this algorithm, but I do want to bring to your attention, Dr. Whitehurst published a very nice review of lower GI bleed management in Surgical Clinics of North America this year. And there are two different flowcharts in here that I found very helpful. First, I'll go back. This is an algorithm for workup of the GI bleed. I'll give you a second if you want a picture. I can distribute the paper as well. And then this is for surgical management of lower GI bleed. So thank you all for coming to our pretty little city of Boston, and go Red Sox.